This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The trial of Noor Salman gets underway this week, with jury selection set to begin Thursday. The widow of the gunman in the Pulse nightclub shooting is charged with providing material support to a terrorist organisation and obstruction of justice. Charles Rose is the director of the Centre for Excellence in Advocacy. He's a professor of excellence in trial advocacy at Stetson University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So Noor Salman, she's been charged with providing material support to a terrorist organisation and obstruction of justice. She faces life in prison if convicted. Professor Rose, what are you expecting to hear from the prosecution as they lay out their case?
I think the prosecution is going to rely in large part upon the very statements made by the defendant, by the accused in this case. If you go and look in detail at her 12-page handwritten letter and the subsequent interview that she had, she's put herself into quite a box from the standpoint of having admitted certain aspects that make the government's case relatively easy, quite frankly.
So if we're talking about some of the other things that the defense might raise, what would some of the arguments or what are some of the other lines of defense you're expecting to see as this trial unfolds?
Well, when you look at the facts as they seem to have been presented in the open source that's been reported by the media, and that's been disclosed in court, what you see is a woman who potentially has a couple of viable defenses on the issue of intent, whether she intended to assist, aid, and abet her husband, and whether or not she obstructed justice with the FBI after the fact by not being completely truthful in the interview. In both of those instances, you have some arguments that, depending upon the facts, you know, how abused she may have been, the way in which her husband did or did not treat her, might give you some grounds to argue that a person in her situation did not feel free to disclose what would be disclosed because of prior abuse. And that's the route that they seem to be going down, that they're going to attack the intent to engage in criminal activity. I think primarily when they took that visit to Disney World and allegedly the Pulse nightclub was cased out. That's going to become the question. What was in her mind and why was it there? Unfortunately for the defense, she has made certain statements that seem to indicate that she knew what was going on and that she wasn't inclined to say anything about it at the time. And remorse after the fact doesn't obviate the intent before the fact. It's going to all come down to what her state of mind was when she chose or to do or not do certain things. And that's, for the defense, a heavy lift, quite frankly, because you've got to convince that jury of folks from that community that she really didn't intend to not keep this from happening. That's going to be hard for her team to do.
The first phase of the trial is picking a jury, and we saw in the lead up to this trial, Noor Salman's lawyers wanted to get that trial moved, saying they didn't think she would get a fair hearing if the trial were held in Orlando. How tough do you think it's going to be to see the jury?
I think it's going to be very hard to see the jury in this particular case. It's hard to think of an event in Florida other than the shooting that just took place down in Parkland that has had so much saturation of national news media coverage. You would have to be living underneath a rock to have not been exposed to some of the coverage in this case. So the question is going to become, how artfully is jury selection done from the standpoint of bias? So you may remember the Casey Anthony case. They had to come over to Pinellas County eventually to pick a jury, and they took a group of Pinellas County jurors and brought them to Orange County for the trial. It may be at some point that we wind up in a similar situation in this trial. We won't know until jury selection begins. There's an art to jury selection, and if her defense attorneys develop their case properly, the government's going to have a hard time getting 12 folks qualified from the Orange County veneer. We'll see what happens.
So what do you think is going to be in or out of bounds as far as picking that jury and finding a jury that is going to be impartial or unbiased?
Well, you'll notice that she's not looking at the death penalty. The maximum punishment that we're concerned with is life in prison. And because the maximum punishment is life in prison, it's going to unfold in a slightly different way than a death penalty case would, because death is always different, even when it comes to jury selection. We're going to be looking at what folks knew, what folks think about it, what people heard. There's also going to be some questions about the jurors' appreciation for different lifestyles and whether or not there might be some bias that's implicit in that thought process. So there are all sorts of potential landmines that could be stepped on during jury selection that could blow up entire groups of potential jurors and make them not eligible to sit in this particular trial. And at the end of the day, we're going to get folks who say they don't know about it, and or who say, if I do know about it, I don't know that much, and what I do know wouldn't influence me one way or the other. That's kind of a hard pill to swallow, given the fact that this was a terrorist event in Central Florida where so many people died under such incredible circumstances. If I was the judge in this case, I would have probably gone to another veneer to pull it. I understand why they didn't, but I would have.
What are some of the things that make a terrorism-related trial different from a regular criminal trial?
Well, terrorism-related trials are, from a legal perspective, it's not much different. The standards of proof are the same. The way in which evidence is introduced, the rules of procedure that apply, the evidentiary rules, those are all the same. But the subtext underneath is remarkably different. There's a fear component to it. There's an ostracization component to it that is unique to terrorism trials. Probably the closest analogy that you could come to would be contested cases where we have child abuse. You know, those cases are different, or where we have really heinous murders. I mean, this is a breed apart, and you've got to mold that into every aspect of the trial, from jury selection through witness preparation and presentation to closing argument. Terrorism will be the issue behind the issue the entire time that this trial is going on.
Is this, to your knowledge, the first time there has been a terrorism trial in Central Florida?
Well, I mean, if you go all the way back to 2004, 2005, and you look at, I think it was Sammy Al-Azir, I think I'd have to go back and check the pronunciation on his last name. He was a USF professor. He was a mathematics professor here, and he was accused of providing aid to Hezbollah and others. That trial happened right here in the Tampa Bay area during a time of intense emotional impact. 9-1-1 was very recent in the minds of American citizens. The federal government was trying very hard to present these cases, and he was ultimately acquitted on almost all charges. So, I mean, we've had them. We haven't had one where you've had, you know, 40 or 50 victims who were gunned down with automatic gunfire. Now, that we have not had. That's fundamentally different.
And if you think about other mass shooting cases, how unusual is it for the spouse of the shooter to be held to account in connection with the case?
The spouse has to have said or done something in the very early phases of the government's investigation that implicated themselves. And in the absence of that, it generally doesn't happen. In this particular instance, arguably she did. That's what this whole trial is going to be about, quite frankly. What she knew, and when did she know it, and what did she do?
I mean, is this in some ways a sort of a proxy trial of Omar Mateen? Can you read it like that at all?
People on the outside looking in might feel that that's what's happening. But what it actually is the trial for the person, from the government's perspective, this is the trial for the person who helped Omar accomplish his goal. So it's a completely different crime. It's a completely different set of circumstances from the actual shooting in the Pulse nightclub. But to the victims of that shooting, to the folks who were present, and to the community of Orlando, it will be viewed as a proxy. But legally speaking, it's not. And in fact, the government needs to be careful that that doesn't flow into their presentation of the case, because if it does, they might create an appealable issue.
Mm-hmm. So what about the idea of a deal? I mean, could you see any circumstance where Noor Salman and her legal team could try and strike a deal in return for a lesser sentence?
The government's case is pretty strong. Why would they deal? What incentive? What could she possibly give them that would make it a viable choice? There's not another co-conspirator that we're aware of. There's not any other terrorist threat. This was a one-off homegrown terrorist activity type thing. The government has a vested interest in showing that anybody who engages in this is going to be punished to the maximum extent of the law. I don't imagine that you're going to see a deal in this case.
So there isn't really much incentive from the prosecutor's point of view either to make a deal with Noor Salman.
What benefit do they get? And at the end of the day, the government doesn't strike deals if there's not a benefit to the government. And most of the work in preparation for this trial has already been done. And it's a relatively easy one to prove as these sorts of trials go. So, you know, if I was the prosecutor sitting in the chair, I'd be looking forward to the case. If I was the defense attorney, I'd be worried.
Having said that, though, is this the kind of case that defense attorneys see as something that could, you know, make a name for themselves?
It would be remiss to think that every lawyer who's involved in this case doesn't think at some level that it will be a benefit to their own personal legal career. I don't doubt that that thought has crossed the mind of every attorney who's involved in the case. But as a defense attorney, the fight is different than as it is for a prosecutor. You've got that client there, and you're the only person between this client and the awesome and overwhelming power of the United States government. Mm-hmm. You're it. And so that burden on your shoulders tends to consume you when you're in this position. What career benefits you might get out of it later, well, that may or may not occur. But if you're doing your job right, you're not thinking about it. Not right now.
Noor Salman gave an interview to the New York Times not long after the shooting, but she hasn't really spoken much to the media. How much more do you think there is to learn about this defendant, and how much are we likely to see? Like, what kind of a picture are we expecting to see build up as the trial progresses?
Well, if she were my client, I'm going to make her, I'm going to show all the ways in which she did not have an opportunity to make decisions in this and how she was swept along by the abusive behavior of her husband. Whether that narrative is true or not is probably the only chance she has to not be convicted. So I would expect from the defense a lot of focus on the intimate details of the marriage, particularly as it related to the way in which she might have been abused or forced to at least have knowledge of things that were reprehensible and then not have the courage to say something about it. Because that's the story that potentially results in an acquittal in this case. I would give up what I had to give up, and I would make all of my narrative about those things. What we don't know, you and I, sitting here right now, is we don't know whether or not there's evidence, that credible evidence that you could put before a jury to do so. If there is, the trial will suddenly become interesting.
Charlie Rose, how long do you think this trial could conceivably take?
My guess is no more than 2 to 3 weeks after jury selection. Now, how long jury selection is going to take, I don't know.
And there have been some pretty high-profile trials in Central Florida. You mentioned at least one of them, the trial of Casey Anthony. But are you expecting this trial to attract the same kind of media attention that some other high-profile trials have?
No, I don't. And the reason is, I think in the minds of most Floridians, she's not a very sympathetic defendant.
Even though the case itself, the shooting at the nightclub, just because of the nature of the event, the fact that 49 people were killed, Orlando was the center of the media world for weeks, if not months.
Oh, I think the trial will be covered, and I think it will get, you know, a valid amount of coverage. But you don't have the narrative that has people pulling for Ms. Salam or thinking that she's innocent. You're not seeing that incredible bifurcation of thought like you did in Casey Anthony, like you've seen in most major media trials like that. You can go all the way back to the Melendez brothers and the O.J. Simpson trial, where there were competing stories, competing narratives of what happened. We have seen very little of her narrative. And that's either because her attorneys have chose not to put it out into the public eye so that the government doesn't have an opportunity to debunk it, or it could be because it just does not exist.
Charles Rose is the director of the Center for Excellence in Advocacy and a law professor at Stetson University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Still to come on Intersection, former NASA astronaut Nicole Stott on why it's important to get girls inspired by science and engineering.
And that's starting, you know, elementary school, middle school, because if we don't get them by middle school, I think there's kind of a detour that they take.
Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. When Nicole Stott was studying at Embry-Riddle, she was the only female in her senior advanced engineering design class. Later, she became a NASA astronaut, flying missions to the International Space Station. From the Education Desk this week, 90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne talks with Nicole Stott about getting girls inspired by science and engineering.
Nicole Stott, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, good to be here with you again.
So what is Introduce a Girl to Engineering Day? Explain what happened.
Oh, I think that's exactly it. I think really the goal is just to expose young women and you know, students who are thinking about something like engineering or may not even know what it is to the opportunities out there. And ultimately, I think it's really about getting women who have done what you might think of as interesting or challenging things in front of these young women to show them that, you know, anything's possible.
I mean, how important is it to young women who are thinking about a career in the STEAM fields or even starting a career in the STEAM fields to have those women role models be a part of their lives and their careers?
Well, I think it's really important. And, you know, I was trying to think back the other day. I was doing a survey interview with somebody about these kinds of things. And they asked that very question about me and how I grew up. You know, were women role models important to me? And in hindsight, I would say I think they really were. At the time, I don't think I realized that there were these particular women coming in to my life that were providing that role model for me. It just was something that was part of my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it just seemed natural that there would be women doing, you know, flying or as engineers or medical doctors or whatever it was, and astronauts. But as I've, you know, gone through this experience myself, I think that it's very important. I think young girls, unlike young boys, and I am not a person who wants to stereotype anybody, but I really feel like from what I've seen, young girls need to have women in front of them. You know, they need the see it, be it kind of thing mm-hmm. to realize that opportunities are out there for them too.
I know you say you didn't recognize it at the time, but thinking back, who were some of those role models? What kind of roles did they play in your career?
Well, I think it started as early as, you know, with my parents, with my mom. My mom and dad were I think, critical role models for me. They just always included me and my sisters in everything they loved doing, you know. My dad was the, you know, the flying one. He liked to build and fly small airplanes, and so we were out at the airport a lot. But my mom, you know, she was the one that was taking us there, and she was the one who was doing all of these other creative things like sewing all of our clothes and, you know, macrame and ceramics and taking me to ballet lessons and those kinds of things and letting me, you know, see that side of things as well. And so it started there. And then I had teachers along the way, you know, in elementary school that where there were kind of extracurricular activities we were doing that were a mix of technology and of the arts. In high school, for sure, One woman that I remember, a teacher, was Mrs. Ransom, and she taught this, elective class in, you know, introduction to aviation and aeronautics. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is so much fun that you could do something like this in high school. You know, it's not just math or science or reading. It was something I was really interested in that applied all of those things to it. And, you know, a couple biology teachers who encouraged me to come into their biology class. And, you know, these were women that knew, I think, that maybe biology wasn't something I was going to do, but they felt like it was important that I get to see, you know, see what went on in, you know, in biology and maybe challenge myself a little bit. and other women that were flying out of the air. I mean, it just goes on and on. But while I was going through it, I don't think I was really acknowledging, wow, this is a woman that's showing me this, or this is a man that's showing me this. It was just that I was having the opportunity to see it. But like you say, in hindsight, I think it was probably very important that there were women in the mix, you know, sharing what they loved with me too, and showing me that really cool stuff can happen, you know, whether you're a boy or a girl. Because bottom line, the rocket ship doesn't care if you're a boy or a girl.
Now, I mean, just going back to that point, I mean, there's sometimes some pushback with, you know, these STEAM initiatives and STEM education that, you know, maybe these kids don't want to even have a career in this. But it sounds to me that it's important that everyone gets exposed to this, right? That's the real push, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's kind of like when I think about my parents just sharing what they loved with me. I think we should be sharing as educators or as, you know, people with, you know, employed in these areas. We should just be sharing what we love about it with students so that they can figure out what they love about it, you know, if anything. And even if they don't go down the path, like, I go out and I talk to kids about, you know, my path to being an astronaut, and, you know, now I'm an artist, and how those two things come together. And they never really were separate for me. They were always kind of this blend. But when I go out as an astronaut to talk to people, my expectation isn't that every kid in that room is going to want to be an astronaut. It's more that they're going to see that I was able to do something that I still pinch myself about. You know, why would they pick me? And that whether it's astronaut or anything else they choose to do, they should be thinking that same way too, that it's possible. And I think that's what it's about. It's just sharing what you love.
Now, the Society for Women Engineers estimates there's less than 20% of women in the engineering industry. Do you have any ideas of how that can change? What needs to be done to make that number tick up a little bit higher?
Well, I'm on the board of trustees at Embry-Riddle as well, and we're facing that challenge there and trying to figure that same thing out. And I really think it's going to come down to being present, like women that are in these fields being present for young girls, and that's starting, you know, elementary school, middle school, because if we don't get them by middle school, I think there's kind of a detour that they take, and it might just be even a self-confidence thing that goes along with it. And so I think it's professional women getting out there and being present for younger girls and showing them these different kinds of paths. And it's also, what I've noticed to be really effective is if you have female students that are right in the middle of, you know, of their education at university, and if we get them out into the, you know, the elementary, middle, and high schools, they are really effective at getting young girls excited about engineering and other STEM-related fields, because they, I don't know, I think they can relate a little bit better than an old lady like I can.
Now, I mean, what's the thinking, you know, back to academics and colleges? I mean, is it important to have, you know, women role models in those positions as well for those students? I mean, thinking back to your college days, did you have a lot of women faculty that were teaching you?
I didn't have a lot of women faculty, but there were some there. And it is. I think it's really important. I think we at the university level need to be starting at the top down, you know, from the administration, the faculty, all of it, to show that, you know, that demographic represents what we want our university mix to be too. And that's a challenge sometimes. You have to make a real effort. And I've never been the kind of person who wants to say, okay, we need to have three women or, you know, people of certain flavors all, you know, that we have to go particularly pick those people out. But we need to be actively ensuring that, you know, as a university, we represent the same kind of mix of students, you know, or mix that we want of our student demographic to be. And that doesn't always sync up. And so I think if you really want to encourage students, especially, you know, female students to enroll in the typically male-dominated curriculums, you have to have your overall university matching that way, too.
And what does the industry lack without this diversity? I mean, thinking back to that 20% statistic from the Society of Women Engineers, I mean, what is missing in the engineering field without more women?
Oh, my gosh. It's like anything. I use this picture in a lot of my presentations that just shows, my astronaut class. You know, there's 17 of us in this group. In our class, well, we had 3 women of the 17. But there's a mix, you know, there's a mix of colors, of, you know, race, of interests, of what we studied at school. I mean, not one of us got to the seat in that picture to be an astronaut the same way. And it's so cool when you think about it, because what that does for you is that you have this mix of backgrounds and expertise that is going to make your mission more successful than if you just had 5 more of you going along, you know? And it's going to be a lot more fun, too, to tell you. But I think that's true in everything. You know, if whether it's, you know, a mix of men or women or just different backgrounds, you're going to have a much more, you're going to have much higher likelihood of success and a much more creative solution to problems than you will if you just have this, you know, mix of the same kind of people.
Are you optimistic that that 20% number will rise in the next 5 years, maybe the next decade?
I am, because I think there's a lot of conversations like this one going on. And I think that it's more than just talking about it. I think there's action coming from it, too. You know, experiences like this, you know, this, you know, Introduce Girls to Engineering Day, that it's a big deal. And it's not just going on at every Riddle. It's going on all over the country, and I would say around the world, too, to just open girls' eyes up to some of the different opportunities out there.
I want to talk a little bit about STEAM here, science, technology, engineering, arts, mathematics. And I want to focus on the A because, as you mentioned before, you have a very unique perspective on this. You are an astronaut, an engineer, but also an artist, the first person to paint in space. You have a very successful art career now. I mean, how does art fit into the hard sciences like technology and engineering?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think we always, it's kind of like science and religion. You know, we don't have to go there today. But I also believe there that there's no reason for this deliberate separation of the two. I think they blend very nicely. Science and art have been doing that forever. You know, if you think about like even recent times with Hubble Space Telescope, mm-hmm. You know, how do even the scientists best understand the data coming back from that telescope? They don't do it with the ones and zeros. They do it with these false colored images that represent, you know, how that star, you know, and what it's made up of. And, you know, that's the way their brain wraps around it. And so to me, it's just, I mean, it's kind of at the basic level of being a human being is that we, I think, understand things that are presented to us in more of a creative way than necessarily just the ones and zeros. And it's about using your whole brain. And yeah, there might be people that are more inclined towards art or science, but a blend of it is what allows us to really, I think, be our most creative. And that's artistically, but that's also from the standpoint of solving really complex problems. I mean, you look at something like the International Space Station, it is one of the most incredibly beautiful designs, you know, that we've ever had. I mean, aesthetically as well as technically. And I think it took, you know, both sides of the brain to make that happen.
Do you think that there's too much of either one way or the other when it comes to kids in school where they have to decide if they either want to pursue a creative career or a scientific career? Have we meshed those together yet?
You know, we used to. And I think what's happening is we're realizing that we really are starting or have been doing that to our kids for a while now. You know, I'm a fan of STEM. I really am. But I think what has happened is that we've pushed that way so deliberately that we've done it at the expense of teaching our kids about humanities and sociology and, you know, the arts. You know, we've kind of excluded those things from our, you know, our kids' curriculum, because we're so thinking, you know, we got to get these technical fields filled. And we do. But I think the best way to do that is to allow our kids to explore and use their whole brain for their whole lives versus forcing them down one path. And I've seen it with my son. You know, they, in schools now, they're really trying to, I mean, I'll drive you in one direction. If you show some like affinity or skill in a particular area, there really is this almost, the people just kind of start getting in there and guiding you directly to that versus allowing you to, you know, to really, for as long as you can in school, evaluate everything. And I think we're at a point where we're starting to recognize that that's not necessarily a good thing. That's why the A, you know, makes so much sense in STEAM and, you know, this intersection between science and art. And I think we're going back, we're going to see a shift back to more of a renaissance-y kind of education for our children.
How old is your son?
He is 15. He is finishing up, I guess they're more than halfway through his ninth grade year in high school, first year of high school.
And does he have ambitions to follow in your footsteps, or is he doing something completely different?
Yeah, you know, not necessarily. I think he'd love to fly in space, you know, but I think when somebody asks him, are you going to be an astronaut? The answer is usually no. And he absolutely is the most naturally talented scuba diver I have ever seen, you know, in the water, just like he was born to do it, and flies drones like he's a professional. And so I think he'll, you know, he'll find something different and interesting to pursue.
And finally, what do you want to tell a young girl who's in, let's say, elementary or middle school right now that might want to follow in your footsteps and be the next Nicole Stott?
Well, I would say, you know, just really, really simply is, you know, pay attention to what you enjoy and let that guide the choices you make for school and career and hobbies, all of it. And what you'll find is that these opportunities just open up through that. And if you're paying attention to what you enjoy with this idea kind of in mind that whatever you're going to do is about, you know, helping improve life here on Earth for all of those around you too, what I've witnessed myself is that you start meeting the people that want to do those same kinds of things. You start having opportunities present themselves to you that you never could have imagined. And it's because you're passionate about what you're doing. And you have figured out how that passion can turn into something important for everyone around you too.
Nicole Stott is an artist, a retired NASA astronaut, and member of the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University Board of Trustees. Nicole, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And 90.7's Brendan Byrne brought us that interview. You can find more of his space reporting on our website, wmfe.org, and on his podcast, Are We There Yet? Still to come, the story of a man who made a fortune and used it to bring a Major League Soccer team to Orlando.
The fundamental idea of having this connection, which goes right back to Phil's early days of being a kid going to watch Stoke City, you know, in the early 1960s, and having this fundamental connection to his sport and the people involved with it.
Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando City Soccer kicks off a new season this Saturday with a match against DC United. The Lions are in rebuilding mode after the departure of superstar Kaká last year. For a look at how soccer has developed in Orlando, we're joined by Simon and Susan Vaness. Well, Simon and Susan Vaness are the authors of Defying Expectations, Phil Rawlins and the Orlando City Soccer Story. First of all, what made you want to write this book?
I think I'd been writing a few stories for The Guardian about Orlando City when they first arrived in 2011. And got to know Phil and Adrian and some of the other people involved in creating the team at that stage. And even at that stage, you could tell that it had huge potential to be more than just a curiosity. It had real legs as a major sporting story. So I was kind of keeping tabs on it the first few years. And then Susan and I, you know, got to know Phil and Kay, and we spoke to them the year before the MLS season rolled around. And we kind of sort of kicked around an idea with Phil, saying, look, if you ever wanted to write a story about this and tell, you know, your full story from the UK to the US, you know, we'd be interested in doing that. And he kind of sort of kept that, you know, under his hat for a little while. And once the 2015 season kicked off, once we were an MLS team, you know, it then became, you know, a very realistic proposition, because it was really clear at that stage from that very first MLS game that this was a major sporting phenomenon and the story really needed to be told.
Susan, Vanessa, what kind of surprised you most about writing the story? Like, what did you learn about Phil Rawlins and his quest to have this MLS team that you weren't expecting to hear from him?
I think one of the things that surprised me the most was actually how he came into his money. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised at this pretty long process that it took for him to get the business that eventually was sold to give him his wealth. But the other thing I think surprised me was how big a role Kay played in sort of bringing the community together around the team and how important that was to her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly we see that now in everything that she's doing.
The Rawlins are now split, right? So she still has an active role in the team. And
absolutely, yes. She still has an active role in the organization, but I think she has an even bigger role now than ever before in the community with some of the things she's done, the outreach in Paramore and having helped start this farmers market type mm-hmm. setup that they have down in Paramore. So, yeah, she's very, very active in it.
And back to the money, too, just for our listeners, how did he come about his money? Like, what was the story of that creation of that business?
Well, I mean, I think it's a real sort of rags-to-riches story in many respects, because Phil came from just about the most working-class background in the UK that you can imagine, from Stoke-on-Trent, which was this heavily industrialised city at the time, back in the early 1960s. It was a coal-mining town, it was a pottery town, so everything was really geared around a very working-class environment. And he came from that, you know, with parents who worked in both the mines and the pottery industry. So mm-hmm. it's about as humble and blue collar as it gets in UK terms. And yet, you know, he came out of that environment, which not many people did in the 1960s. They tended to stay where they were born. But Phil realized that there were other things to do in the world. And he just had an experiential learning ethic that really stuck with him from his very early days that led him into the computer industry, which at that stage, you know, in the early 1980s, it was still in its very formative stages. And he got into a sales marketing role for Hewlett-Packard in the UK, and then parlayed that into his own business with his business partner that just took off with a huge amount of imagination at work and sort of diligence at creating something that was really timely for that period, and just sort of got into, you know, managed to find the pulse of an industry that needed sort of not necessarily streamlining, but there was a great deal of work to be done in that to create a presence for a business. Mm-hmm. And over the course of 15 years or so, that's pretty much what he did. And from those very humble roots, he then, you know, created a company that was sold for $250 million in 1999. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that really grabs your attention.
Right. So then he's got $250 million in his pocket. He's like, what am I going to do with this? I'm going to buy a soccer team.
It wasn't quite like that, because there was a period when he was still in consultancy work in the computer sales business. But gradually he started looking around and saying, what else do I want to do? And his first subject, really, or his first project, was to go back to Stoke City and his hometown team mm-hmm. and say, I mean, they were very much in the doldrums at the time, and say, how can I help? How can I invest? How can I bring my business sort of initiative to bear on helping the team out from where it was, which was the third, you know, level of mm-hmm. English professional soccer at that stage. So that's what he got involved with. He then came back to the US with another sort of a business interest and was looking around there, and with sort of Stoke City on one hand and being in Texas as he was at the other hand, and seeing at that point, this is 2007, which was the year David Beckham came to MLS, and there was suddenly this international focus on the league. So Phil is looking at his sort of soccer background and what's happening here in the US and saying, well, there might be something here. And the eternal fascination with this story is the fact that he and Kay sat down at their kitchen table in Austin, Texas, and said, OK, well, if we were to create our own team, what would it be? And they set out these six core values, as you know, we detail in the book, and that was become the foundation, the bedrock, if you like, of what, first of all, Austin Aztecs was hopefully going to be. And when that didn't work, and they started looking around for where it would work, because they were convinced that the idea was sound, it just wasn't the right location. Mm-hmm. And Orlando came up on the radar. It was like, you know, three cherries in a row on the, you know, the slot machine. Mm-hmm. And bingo, they had a real prospect on their hands.
Susan, do you know if anybody tried to talk him out of investing his money into a sports team along the way? Because in some ways it seems kind of a little bit quixotic, right? You have a lot of money, you're like, what am I going to do with it? Does a sports team seem like a good business investment?
I think if you have Phil's background, it seems like the best business investment. He and Kay were very dedicated to their teams in the UK. Mm-hmm. So whether or not it really was, I'm not sure if they ever looked at it and said, is this a great investment? Or if they just looked at it and said, this is what we want to do.
So when you look at the impact that Orlando City has had, not just on Paramore, but the city itself, how has it changed Orlando, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that Orlando City has created a awareness of soccer that wasn't there before. It's created a community connection with soccer and with sport in particular. And without wishing to be unkind to the Orlando Magic, they have been around for long enough now to have established themselves and to be able to create the kind of connection that you thought they would make. But Orlando City came into what was essentially a vacuum in sort of sporting community terms and really, you know, lit the light bulb of reality for what was possible. And I think that they have certainly created an awareness of soccer and an ability to connect with it because of the way that the team was set up, because of what Phil and Kay wanted to do, because of the links they created with Buddy Dyer as the city mayor, with other business leaders, with getting out into the community and having a genuine, heartfelt outreach, that they created this genuine core belief in soccer and in a sports entity that gave them so much more credibility and so much more goodwill going backwards and forwards. The fans will certainly tell you that they were in love with the idea of Orlando City, because Phil and Kay put themselves out there so much. They went and, you know, sat with the fans, you know, at the Citrus Bowl in the early days. They went out to the tailgate parties. They met with them, you know, at other functions. They really put themselves out there. And they had the right coach in Adrian Heath. They had the right support partners in people like John Bonner and you know, the big money man Flavio Augusto da Silva, who, mm-hmm. who, when he came in, took the club financially to a new level. But everything was geared around those community roots and the fundamental idea of having this connection, which goes right back to Phil's early days of being a kid going to watch Stoke City, you know, in the early 1960s, and having this fundamental connection to his sport and the people involved with it. And, you know, if you like, what the book does sort of highlight is the fact, what makes soccer special? And it's this feeling of ritual. It's a feeling of having this sort of tribal connection with the fans, a sense of belonging. When you go to a game, you're with the people who are all cheering in the same way that you are. And then it comes down to the visual drama, this setting, this vivid green 3D setting of a stage that unrolls this amazing play over 90 minutes that the whole fans are into for every minute of the game. And it is a purely visceral and fundamental sort of human connection that really goes back to soccer's roots in the early parts of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and is so amazing that we've got it here now in Orlando, in 21st century Orlando, which has got this modern urban face, mm-hmm. and we've got this sort of ages-old connection with community and this wonderful human theatre.
You can see the impact on the community every time you drive around. You can't drive more than a mile without seeing an Orlando City magnet on the back of a car. Mm-hmm. They're just everywhere. If you went to a game, they'd have people out there sticking those magnets on the back of your car. And when you came out to your car, it was almost like a little gift waiting for you, this, you know, this surprise. Now you've got this piece of your team.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I don't know how many times we've had ours stolen off the back of our car, but they just keep showing up again.
Yep.
So it's really a neat thing to have.
Susan, Vanessa, I wanted to ask you too. I mean, do you think that soccer is kind of unique in the sort of tribalism that Simon's talking about? I mean, do you see that in the support for other sports, like whether it's basketball or football? Or is there something kind of unique about soccer which it lends itself to the support we've seen for Orlando City in the last few years?
I think the closest that I can come to that similarity is college football.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up on the campus of MSU, and that whole vibe that you get around game day here in Orlando, that's what I remember growing up on campus at Michigan State. So I think there are similarities, and there are also some pretty big differences.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about Kay Rawlins and how she's been very involved with the community, like setting up these, you know, getting them interested in soccer from a young age. That would have dividends down the track if you're interested in just promoting soccer as a sport in general, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think a lot of her motivation is bettering the lives of the people that she comes in contact with. But I think, yeah, it is also about, you know, bringing up this whole new generation of soccer-playing kids.
You mentioned David Beckham at the start of our conversation, too. He's kind of back in the MLS scene, too, right? Launching a team in South Florida.
Yeah, still trying to get it off the ground. I mean, I think there's still question marks around exactly how he's going to do it. I mean, he needs to have a name for the team to start with. He needs to have, you know, a firm plan of when this is going to be. And he also needs to have a little bit more support from the community out there, and I think that he's getting at the moment, because there is a lot of scepticism. He's been trying to do this now since 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So he's nearly five years down the road and still doesn't have a team name or any players. So although he and his business partners have got their plan in mind, there's still a disconnect there that I can see between the reality and the desire to do this. And I think they've still got a ways to go to really be able to nail that down. And, you know, in 2020, which is probably the earliest they could make it, come out of the starting gate with a fully functioning team. So
mm-hmm.
MLS needs a team in Miami. It really wants to have a team. It wants to create a Florida rivalry as well, an interstate rivalry, as well as, you know, having teams other nearby. So it's desperate for this to happen. But I think, you know, knowing the politics of Miami, you know, how, you know, sports stadiums there have not been the most popular subject on the political agenda, and the other, you know, problems of dealing with a major city like that, getting all the land that you need, getting the right building permits and taking it through to completion, they've still got a task on their hands.
Well, the book is Defying Expectations, Phil Rawlins and the Orlando City Soccer Story. The authors are Simon Vaness and Susan Vaness. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
And Simon Vaness, thank you as well.
Always a pleasure, Matthew.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is brought to you by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. You can download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Find us online at wmfe.org/intersection, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.